now you'll be there when the model shop is open, so you should definitely go.
I love that, like, planning a 4-day work trip, it revolves around, but will the airplane model shop be open?
Well, that's for me. I mean...
I'm not saying it doesn't apply to me also. I'm just laughing at the circumstances.
You're listening to Dots, Lines, and Destinations, a travel podcast with hosts Stephen Seagraves, Foz Mamoon, and Seth Miller. So, my least favorite plane apparently is going to come back with a vengeance for United, the CRJ-200.
Aggressive.
Aggressive.
Aggressive is the word we're using. They're going to be aggressive.
Yeah. I hate the CR-2. Can I just say that? It's probably the worst regional jet ever designed.
It's great for its original purpose.
Like, ultra short haul, 50 seats.
No. What was originally designed as a business jet.
Well, yeah, okay. I thought you were talking about for its commercial purposes. Smartass.
That's me.
Can't be surprised.
So United is saying they've signed an agreement with Air Wisconsin, who I like to refer to as Air Whiskey.
They refer to themselves as too.
Oh, so, do they? Okay, well, it makes
sense. I think that's their call sign.
Yeah, I think it is too. And that agreement includes, is it 64 CR2s as part of what they'll be flying for United?
Yeah, it's a capacity purchase agreement. Now, I read the letter from Scott Kirby to the pilots and whatever. And what I saw in it is that they're not increasing the number of CR2s flying, but they're also not cutting them. They're just moving them between operators.
Okay.
And they're shifting routes significantly. So it's a bunch of new routes being added. And like one of the things he specifically called out was the Newark-Atlanta service that went from 8 737s to 5 ERJs, and acknowledging that that was bad for picking up corporate traffic. And so by this summer, they're going to be back to 8 737s. Skipped over or at least 8 mainline, maybe some Airbus, I'm not sure, but skipped over the part where they made that change mostly because they got rid of most of their smaller 737s, right? When Continental operated it with so many frequencies, it was on 735s, not 738s that have 50 seats more. But the point was, you need to have the frequencies and you need the times to attract the high value business travelers. And so it's part of it is frequencies. Part of it is the actual product flying, I think, is what it comes down to. And whereas before it was all about like, as long as we have enough frequencies, it's okay. Yeah. Kirby taking the approach of maybe we actually want to put real planes on there too.
Yeah, that's something for me. I mean, living in Portland, we had the CR2 service. We still do every now and then to Denver. That's a 2.5-hour flight on a CR2. That's
I was booked on that once.
What's that?
I was booked on that once.
Yeah? I'm sorry.
I didn't take it. I say they changed to Chicago. I got to get out early.
Smart man.
Yeah, I mean, the CR2s, I feel like in some cases they're just overusing them. It's fine for displacing prop planes, but like Burbank, San Jose, Oakland to Denver, Portland to Denver, these are just routes they shouldn't be flying those out.
Yeah. Yeah. And do you think part of that is like they're trying to rotate the pilots? So like they have to get the pilots back to Denver for their other routes, and maybe they flew for Delta like for crew scheduling purposes?
I don't think there's that much cross-pollination in the crews. I think you're flying a schedule for a particular carrier for the run of your schedule.
True.
I've never really seen them change carriers midstream unless it's an irregular operation.
Yeah, there's been a few cases where Delta planes have shown up at United gates.
But I don't think that's necessarily planned. I think that's outlier.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Erupts. Like I've heard of the occasional case where a crew's like, oh, I was supposed to work a Delta flight, but I'm working this now. But it was because someone called in sick or something. It wasn't like they had to go into the bathroom and come out like Superman in a new uniform.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. That makes sense.
Yeah. What I was going to say is I think, one of the big challenges and one of the reasons this is happening is some of the other operators United uses are getting out of the 50-seat business.
Mm. Yep.
Right? I mean, I don't know if we've talked about, but, the bigger picture, the world has been talking about sort of pilot shortage challenges.
Yep.
And we don't have enough pilots and this and that. And, this is one of those you know, they say shit rolls downhill. In this case, sort of shit's rolling uphill, where the smallest planes are getting canceled first, and we're starting to see it creep up and up and up. And you know, some airlines are getting out of 50-seater.
Well, from what I read in Kirby's memo, all these planes are currently flying for American.
And so their Air Wisconsin's agreement is going to move some of that capacity. Well, I guess they're kind of swapping capacity, right? Because who was operating these before? Was it SkyWest?
It was Air Wisconsin.
Well, that's interesting.
But United had SkyWest flying some of its 50s.
I think they've all been gone at this point. I think these are the planes that Air Whiskey's been flying for what was previously U.S. Air.
Oh, okay. That makes a little sense.
So, you know, one man's trash is another man's treasure.
And when it's Scott Kirby.
You just can't seem to get rid of those guys.
So they announced a few routes, right? But they didn't say these were necessarily going to be CR2 routes. Like, they're going to start flying to Rochester from, is it Denver? Chicago to Rochester. Okay. They're going to start Denver to Columbia, Missouri, which I think is going to be an ERJ. What else? There was something else. It was kind of an interesting, different airport. I can't remember what it was now. Dang it.
Was Branson one of those?
No, Branson was.
It's Columbus?
Yeah, Columbus is the one I was talking about. Columbus, Missouri. And I'm looking it up right now. Since we don't have the producer on the show. Yeah, we have a producer.
Okay, so these are all mainline. Dulles to Roanoke. Probably be a CRJ-2 is my guess.
Now, that route used to exist.
It exists now. It's going from 2 to 3.
Oh, that's not exciting.
Sorry. They're also adding capacity on some of these routes. I'm trying to find all the information.
Yeah, to me, some of the interesting ones there was the... I mean, Stephen, for you, also fun, the additional Transcon from Portland to Newark.
Yep.
They're adding Sacramento back.
From Newark.
Newark Transcon.
Yep.
Trying to remember what the other one was. There's a couple other longer stage flights. So obviously, there's the San Francisco Munich seasonal service.
Which is exciting.
788, right?
Yep.
Interesting. I mean, you now have United doing the sort of early bank out of San Francisco to the Lufthansa hubs to provide onward connections. So that United does the two sort of 2 p.m. ish flights, and Lufthansa does the later flights.
I just checked. Air Wisconsin currently has 66 CR2s.
Wow.
So the numbers seem to line up.
Crazy. So let's see here. I think you're right, Seth. Like, some of the interesting pieces, like San Francisco Munich as a seasonal. I mean, it's summer seasonal. Which makes a lot of sense, Munich being Lufthansa's big hub, one of Lufthansa's big hubs. So that one makes sense to me.
The challenge I see there is when you keep hearing comments about, like, transatlantic market yields suck.
Yeah.
Right? Transatlantic market yields continue to feel pressure. Whatever version of the holy shit, we're hemorrhaging cash here story you want to hear. And then you look at it and Thomas Cook is running San Francisco next summer. Virgin Atlantic is also going to run Manchester to San Francisco next summer. And that may even be year end. I'm not sure. There's across the bay in Oakland, you've got a few flights. You've got BA adding capacity into Oakland to try to compete with Norwegian out of London. But, I mean, that's more O&D than what United's going to get on connections onward from Munich, but it's part of what you're competing against.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
So, cool. I mean, good that the chasm is lower on the 787 than the 767s, I guess, but, like, at some level, I do wonder about picking a fight in markets where you're constantly complaining about lower and lower yields. Mm-hmm. That said, it is only a seasonal route, right? They're not going to try to run it in the winter when the plane would presumably be empty.
Well, let's also look at what's happening on the domestic side, right? So United withdrew in a lot of domestic markets because they didn't want to compete. And what we're seeing now is they realized that was a mistake.
Yeah.
So maybe they're trying to prevent the same mistake and not going too crazy on the reductions.
Yeah, and I mean, that was actually another interesting thing in the memo from Kirby, was essentially that he acknowledges, you know, he states outright, Denver's our most profitable hub because we connect so many people through there, which is weird in the sense that typically you think of O&D traffic as being the high-yield stuff. And so I guess it's connecting small market to small market where you can just charge an arm and a leg. I don't know, but...
That's probably what it is, right? Think of all those secondary markets or tertiary markets they serve out of Denver that no one else serves. There's a lot of essential area markets out of Denver.
Yeah.
Well, and most of them are being sadly flown with CR2s.
Well, it's either that or
no
drive.
Service or no service at all. Yeah, that's true.
I mean that's a trade. It's a trade-off, right? Is a CR2 better than a prop plane versus or no service?
Yeah,
I would argue it is. You know, so you got to look at. I mean, I'm not so opposed to CR2s if they use them on the right routes, but this ridiculousness there where they fly them from Denver to the West Coast, that just needs to stop.
Yeah. Do you think some of this West Coast? So there's a few West Coast additions. Let's see here. So they're going to do Newark to Sacramento, Newark to Salt Lake City. They're upping Newark to Atlanta, upping Newark to Detroit, increasing to PDX. But then they're also doing Denver to Columbia, Missouri, Denver to San Luis Obispo, Denver to a bunch of Florida destinations. And I wonder, and then on top of that, you're doing San Francisco to Santa Rosa, California, so the wine country, which is interesting. I mean, it's kind of weird, right? Spokane.
How long? That flight, Santa Rosa, that's like 8 miles, isn't it?
I guess. No,
it's probably about 45, 50 miles, but it can be a very big challenge to drive
with traffic.
Yeah,
yeah.
66 miles. Does that take over as United's new shortest route?
I don't know.
Do we still have Guam Saipan?
I think Guam Saipan probably takes the cake. Yeah, I would think.
No, Guam Saipan's 129.
Oh,
huh.
I mean, that's shorter than. I mean, that's almost. So there's Beaumont, Houston. That doesn't exist anymore. So it might. I mean, the point of that might be like some of this West Coast stuff. I wonder how much it is like fortressing the West Coast against the coming Virgin merger.
Well, here's what you have to remember about Santa Rosa. Nobody flies from. Most people don't get to go nonstop from there. They're gonna have to connect somewhere.
Yep.
So it makes sense in that regard to just dump those people to San Francisco to get capture the traffic. Otherwise, most people are flying down to LA.
Seth.
Yeah, I actually flew LA, Santa Rosa, Portland.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
That was the same trip where I had the CR2 to Denver booked and I changed it. this whole episode is all about that trip, apparently.
Another
3 months later.
Another interesting one is San Francisco, Hartford. Like,
yeah, Bradley, that's going to be interesting.
That's an interesting transcon right there. So it's just there's a bunch of stuff in here.
Yeah, I feel like Hartford/Bradley is like one of those markets. I mean, obviously, like the insurance market is still there and is still doing decent business. But I feel like that's one of those markets that has come and gone a little bit, and it's on the upswing. You know, we're seeing Aer Lingus has showed up there. Norwegian is going to put some of its transatlantic flights there. Like it's starting to grow again. So I don't know why. I think it's a dump.
Well, more importantly, if you look at the morning, if you look at the westbound flight, it connects to the Asian Bank.
Okay, then that's what it is.
Yeah, because it gets in at 9:46. What's strange is the return is a red eye, though.
That's all. Yeah, that's what works for fleet and crew utilization, but it's asymmetrical for those connecting passengers.
Yeah, but the counterpoint is, you know, AA launched Hartford what 3 years ago, 4 years ago, and it went away, and then it came back. And so I know Hartford isn't giving subsidies as well, so that might have something to do with it.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah, I'll be interested to see how that performs and how long it sticks around. If it does, maybe it will. Maybe it'll stick around longer. I mean, if I'm going to the West Coast, that's definitely better than connecting through Chicago, I guess. Just take
it's only
on-stop.
It's only a 319.
Yeah. So they won't have a ton of people on it.
Yeah. I mean, when you think about it, AA flies a 738. Or what, unless they recently downsized it. But historically, they've flown to 738, so they've had, you know, another 40 extra seats to fill.
Yeah, yeah. And another thing to note in Kirby's letter is that he points out that they can't add any additional flying at LAX right now because they need more gates before they can have some growth.
Which I don't understand. They have the most gates.
Well, you know, we got called out on our site with a comment about
that we screwed that whole episode up, but no indication of what we actually got wrong, so I'm not too worried about it. No, I'm sure we got things wrong. I just, if you're going to tell me I screwed up, it's useful to tell me what I screwed up. Speaking of which, Guam to Rota will remain the shortest route at 56 miles,
yeah.
Despite the Santa Rosa coming in at 66.
I think they need to bring back Orange County LAX.
The traffic beater?
Dude, that was the best flight ever.
So let's see here. What else we got on the storyline?
77Ws while we're talking about United Fleet.
Oh, yeah, and we can talk about routes and stuff, too, there. So the 77W is flying now. We're not doing a dot line of destination of the week. If you're a listener, sorry. but San Francisco-Hong Kong will be the first route. And the 77W is now flying. Foz, have you been on it yet? Did you take your Transcon trip?
No, I had to cancel it.
Oh, but Seth got to fly on it.
I know.
It's part of the media.
Yes. Yes, I did.
How was it, Seth?
I advise against sitting in the back.
Heavily?
No, I mean, welcome to the 10 across 777s, man. They suck. So does the 9 abreast 787s. The unfortunate part is it's sort of a way of life at this point. It's, you know, more and more planes are flying that way. So without a proper premium economy product, United doesn't give a lot of options for, you know, market segmentation. They talk about we want to have the right product for the different segments in the market. And what they're skipping right now is the segment of people who are price sensitive, but also just can't anymore. And I put up with a lot of shit in coach, but that is a level to which I just can't anymore. And so you can actually get more money from me if you can put a premium economy product out. British Airways proved that this quarter, where I'm flying them back and forth across the Atlantic like 5 times because of it.
And because you posted some photos of the coach experience, and it just looks unbelievably tight. Like, I can't even describe how tight it. You just have to post a picture because it just looks miserable. I mean, I've seen the back of a 744, which is 343 as well, and there still feels like there's more room back there.
Well, there is. The 744 is a wider fuselage.
Yeah.
Wider seats. Not massively wider, but it's wider.
I mean, it looked like you were shoulder to shoulder with everyone you were sitting next to.
Yeah, I was sitting next to two other guys. I'm the biggest of the three.
And you're not a huge guy.
I'm not a huge guy. I am 5'11", 195 these days. I'm relatively average in size. Yep. My shoulders are a little broader, but we were arm to arm. If the three of us all sat upright and leaning back, and it wasn't shoulder to shoulder, it was like elbow to shoulder, full contact, the full upper arm.
Yep.
It's, you know, I'm trying to come up with a sort of middle ground on it. And I get that that's sort of what everybody's doing. And so at some level, I don't have a choice. But, man, is it, hope you know the person you're sitting next to. And, you know, in theory, I guess the other theory is if they really are selling the seats that cheap, but not in premium economy, buy three for two people.
Yeah. Yeah. Keep the middle one open for you.
And keep the middle seat open. If you can get the block of three on one side, that might make it, you know, if they really are making them that cheap, which to be seen if they really are or not, but if they can make them that cheap, I think that's arguably the, like, healthy, safe way to make that happen.
But will they let you block it?
Sure. You can buy an extra seat.
Yep. Yeah, you can actually purchase it. Yep.
And I think you earn RDMs but not EQMs?
Yep, that's correct.
Or vice versa? I forget which one.
Yeah, there's a tutorial out there on how to actually book it and stuff so that it works and they don't get...
Yeah, it's theoretically for passengers of size or if you have a... Whatever, a cello or whatever. Almost would fit normally, but...
Yeah, I mean, and so the first route being San Francisco-Hong Kong... is a bit of a disappointment for me. I mean, it's a disappointment for me because the 744 won't be on the route anymore, but these are going to be on long routes where the comfort factor will come into play.
Yeah, and I think that's the part of it that I was sort of trying to get at. So is the 787,
yep.
Right? And with 9 abreast, like I can handle the squeeze for the 2 or 3 hours or 4 hours on a European low cost carrier. And these, at least we get the extra inch or two of legroom that the European LCCs take away. But these are also going to be 16-hour flights, not 4-hour flights or 3-hour flights or 90-minute flights. So it's just, I get why it's happening. I understand the economics of it, but that doesn't mean I have to like it.
Can you speak to the business class cabin?
Oh, yeah, yeah. It's really nice. it is. It's, you know, I think my complaint, if I had to come up with one, is if you like window seats and talking to the person you're flying with, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And I do like window seats, and I like occasionally talking to my wife when we travel together. So that's bad.
But can you use that on any of the current products?
Not really.
United, sure.
Well, yeah, current United product, yeah.
But any of the new...
None of the direct aisle access products support that. So, and arguably United is a little better than most on that front. In the way the seats are laid out. You know, it's interesting that there's basically three different seats on board, and you have the bulkhead, you have the sort of straight ahead seats, and you have the slightly angled seats. And depending on your body type and how you like to sleep, different seats will be better for different people. I mean, someone said they preferred the angled seat for sleeping on their side because the sort of seat well around your hips is larger.
Mm.
And it is. I mean, you can measure it. It's a couple inches wider. And that, if you sleep on your side and sort of, you know, the way you curl up sort of slightly prone, it makes that fit better. If you're a back sleeper or a front sleeper, that's less important. Now, the problem with the angle, you know, I use the term problem loosely, but the problem with the sort of angled seats is the footwell narrows more sharply, shall we say.
Mm.
So you lose some of the length of the bed when that happens. You know, all of them measure 6'8" tip to toe, but that one at the last 10 inches of it or so is not the full width of the footwell. So it's tapering off. So yeah, it's 6'8", but you only get 5'8" of sort of full width. And then after that, your toes got it. So you have to sleep on your side, I think, is really what it comes down to, so that your feet are one on top of the other and sort of toes pointed into the cubby hole to make that work.
Interesting.
Yeah, but I think it's a really nice product. I think there's a lot of nice things they did. One of them is actually funny. During the pre-flight for the media day, Oscar Munoz gave his little welcome to the party speech, and he was actually on board too. He tried to deny me boarding. Did I tell you guys that?
No. He knew who you were.
He was running the boarding pass. I was the first guy on, and he was cracking jokes. But he collected boarding passes at the gate as we all boarded. And my camera, like, I saw him doing it. I tried to hit record, and I messed it up, so I didn't get it. But he sees me, and he's like, oh, no, this guy looks sketchy. We're denying him boarding. And then he took my boarding pass anyways. yeah, he tried to deny me boarding. But during the sort of party in the lounge, when we were talking before the flight, he mentions, you know, started talking a little bit about his personal relationship with the new product, and how after a lot of the design work was already done, he came in to sort of review it, and that was right after his heart attack and the surgery. And he suggested alterations even sort of at the last minute that made it into the product. And one of them is there's a handle on top of the seat in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
So when you want to stand up and sort of pull yourself up, there's actually something you're supposed to grab onto now, instead of like gripping around and trying not to rip the whole seat apart.
Yeah. Yeah. And, or grabbing, accidentally hitting the person in front of you. Like they're actually.
Yeah. Like there's a lot of little things like that. So it's like, and it's, you know, is what it is. And whether, you know, does that make or break the product? No, but it's a nice little feature. I used it a couple times and thought we were on the trip, I was like, you know, this is actually a nice thing to have here. You know, it does help you get up and down a little easier.
But so. It's funny. A lot of people don't even realize that these are there, but the footstep, I had something in the back of an overhead bin, and there's a footstep underneath most seats.
Yeah.
And I stood on that, and the lady behind me was like, I never even knew that was there.
So you just got to be careful that it's actually a footstep and not just that sort of protective bar.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
That if you step on, will like pull the whole seat apart.
Yeah, no, it was actually like
yeah, you could tell it's like a step. Like a 4-inch wide cutout thing. That's yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, those are fun. Usually wide bodies going into the middle is where you'll see those.
Yep, exactly.
To the middle bins. But no, I think they did some really nice things with the business class cabin, the Polaris cabin. One of the arguable limitations of the straight ahead seats up there is like that there's like a notch to get in and out.
Mm-hmm.
And it's 8 or 9 inches wide. So depending on how thick your thighs are, you could see that as challenging.
Interesting.
If they make that any bigger, you like lose seat space or something else. So it's sort of a, you know, compromise, but it was, it felt like it could be seen. It could be tight in some cases.
The one feature I like, because I've seen it on other carriers before, and I'm just glad they're going to have it, is the ability to get out of your seat with the tray table out. Like spinning it around. I like that idea.
I don't remember being able to do it fully loaded with food.
Oh, okay.
But I think if it was half loaded, you should still do it.
Okay.
But yeah, you could get up during your wine tasting, but not during dinner.
Because one of my big complaints is that usually, if depending on how the service is going, I might need to go to the bathroom, and I'm not going to see somebody for 15 minutes. And
yeah. Only 15?
Yeah, maybe more. I was trying to be nice. I failed. Anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's cool. And the lighting looked really neat.
It's very blue.
It looks very, yeah, it does look very, harsh.
it's not harsh. It's just very blue. I understand like the theory that mood lighting matters. I'm not entirely sure I buy it, but, it's a very blue
and
very on brand. It's very blue.
And there was another route announced too, right? Or kind of rumored. It's Newark Tel Aviv will be the second one, and it'll be the late night flight in both directions, I think.
Yeah, 1991.
Yeah.
Subject to government approval.
Subject to government approval, and
Is that going to approve a change of type?
That's what it said.
Interesting. I mean, I obviously can't imagine it's denied, but it's interesting to see it that way.
Yeah, I think it's a smart move. I mean, I'm sure there's a ton of premium traffic, right? I mean, between Newark and Tel Aviv.
Yeah, there's a ton of low-yield traffic, too. It's just a high-volume route.
Yeah, yeah. And so having the bigger plane, I mean, they're basically almost doubling the capacity of coach, right? From a 772?
Yeah, it's a big jump. It's like, that's up to like, yeah, it's huge.
Yeah. And I would wonder, you know, how, if San Francisco Tel Aviv starts doing really well again, if they move that up to a 789 eventually or seasonally, I could see that with the tech market and things and serving the West Coast. So just some interesting things going on there. And so what else do you guys see coming in the future for the 77W?
Asia from San Francisco.
That's it, you think? So they're going to have to do a transcon, right?
I think Frankfurt from San Francisco.
For the one flight?
I think any 744 flight is likely to see a 77W.
So you've got that going to Seoul now. You've got that to Taipei.
I do wonder about Seoul. I wonder if you could downgauge that to a 772 as the things cycle around. Like that, I don't know, man. That route always seems like it's dirt cheap.
Yep.
Plenty of availability for upgrades.
I think they've put a 744 on that route because they can Target. Use well no. They can use both Korean and Singapore as overflow if they have an air op. They can afford to have problems because the 744s are problematic. They can afford to have problems because at one point it was the 772 for a long, long time.
Yep.
And the 74 is only recent.
Yep. And I think almost the same thing with Taipei. Like I wonder about how I think Taipei has some really strong days where it does really well.
I think Taipei is cargo driven.
Oh, like just filling the old evergreen gaps.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much cargo that comes out of Taipei.
Yeah, so I maybe they can make the 77W work on Taipei because they'd simply be financing it with cargo. But those were the two routes where I was kind of like, eh, I don't know.
I don't think they put it on Taipei in the short term because that seat is more valuable in other markets.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, that's the one thing I remember. I don't remember if it was Kirby or Munoz who said it, but when they adjusted the plan and stopped, you know, when they said they're going to pull it out of Newark and put it in San Francisco, it was all about competing in the long-haul business markets where, the, you know, the Asian carriers had a stronger offering. And, does the ER make – I guess it must. Does it make Singapore work?
No, you can't do San Francisco-Singapore on that.
That's why they stop in Narita and Seoul.
Yeah.
That was the 77. That's why Singapore does.
Yeah. Yep. That's why.
But if the plane can't make it.
Yeah. Okay. Scratch that plan.
So you mean do you think then that they'll? I think they have to move some of the Newark 772s to maybe Chicago or something to make some of this work.
I don't think so. Definitely not Chicago. But Chicago's already killed its 744s and is doing okay. Maybe there's some seasonal upgauging and stuff, but right now Chicago's okay. I think if you look at the schedule now, I think it's if you get all 14 running, you could do a straight 1-1 swap for the 744s that are still in operation and be damn close. You know, you're putting one to Tel Aviv out of Newark, so it's not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's also not forget that there's a bunch of 772s that are going to start coming out of the maintenance base.
Yeah.
This spring.
Mm. Gotcha. So... And that means with the Newark Tel Aviv flight, they're going to have to do a transcon to feed that flight, right? They're going to have to do – unless they have another route planned for Newark where they can
– They will probably do London to move it back and forth or Frankfurt.
Oh, okay. So they'll do like Newark, London, London, Newark, Tel Aviv.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Or San Francisco, London, Newark, Tel Aviv, Newark, London, San Francisco.
Yeah, yeah.
Did I do this in the right order?
I think so. Yeah. just cool stuff. I'm excited to fly one in business class, and that's about it. So we'll see how it goes. Let's talk about Foz's last days as an executive platinum. It's a sad day. Dun, dun, dun. Yeah, right?
No, you just were playing the wedding march, Stephen.
Oh.
You were trying to play taps.
Yeah. Can you just insert that here, Seth, please?
Oops.
It's been a long day, guys.
That was amazing.
Oh, God. That was perfect.
So, Foz, you're marrying American Airlines.
I feel really stupid now.
No. No, today is actually my last day as an executive platinum, and I don't think I will ever hold that status again.
Yeah, we're recording this on February 28th, so last day of the month.
Yeah.
It's also your, is it your last day with whatever Hyatt status you had? Because you're now a globalist or whatever? Some other stupid name?
Yeah, it should be globalist tomorrow. We'll see what we'll see
explorist,
how.
Explorist? Is Explorerist one of them? Is that possible?
Explorer, I think, is one. Globalist? We know how well the travel industry's IT works, so we'll see what actually happens tomorrow.
Yeah. Usually it works pretty well when they're taking stuff away.
Sometimes, not always. No, I mean, it's funny, because the more I fly AA, the more I feel it is becoming like pre-merger United.
Mm.
And I say this because I flew San Francisco JFK last night, and they're still flying an F cabin on this plane, and of the 10 seats, 8 were non-refs.
Wow.
And they have this policy where they will not op up people from business into first to get additional people into the back. It just bothers me.
To clear coach seats?
They won't move people up the chain, exactly.
Are these standbys or oversells?
Sometimes both.
Oversells, you'd think they would. Standbys, I understand, and United had that policy for a long time, still does, I think, right? I mean, you can op up to handle an oversell, but you don't double upgrade someone. You don't push someone from business to first just to clear another business upgrade, things like that.
Well, United was doing that for a while when they had PS. And I don't know what they're doing on the – and I think even on the international stuff they're doing that, because I've had that happen a few times where on an upgraded fare, I get upgraded into first on international. So, I mean, whereas, you know, United's been looking at more of let's just fill the plane – AA's, you know, in this mode of we just want to protect this cabin, this F cabin, but we'll put all these non-revs up there. Which it goes back to what, you know, the old joke of it being employee class.
Yeah.
Which then brings up the point: is first class really worth it at this point at a domestic airline?
No. Sorry, was there supposed to be a pause there for pondering and consideration?
No, it doesn't need to be.
It's funny you say that. I had a friend last night who doesn't fly a ton, but, you know, buys the ticket she wants and goes where she wants to go, and was going out to Las Vegas for a weekend with some, you know, family and friends from New York, and looked at it, and it was like $750 in coach and only $1,000 in business class, or, you know, domestic first. Mm-hmm. And so she paid for the first class. She's like, that's cheap. I'll just, you know, call it a $300 upgrade round trip. That's actually not so bad. And her comment to me was, and as I got on the plane and looked down at the seat, I was like, why the hell did I just pay this?
Was she on Virgin America?
No, she's on United.
Wow.
So, yeah. Interesting.
Well,
and she's not wrong, right? Like, I mean,
no.
The product has become more space, and, you know, it goes back to the conversation we were having at the beginning about the 77Ws, but at least the domestic cabin hasn't gotten that much tighter yet, because you can only go 6 across on all those planes. You get a little more space, you get a little more food, but no one's flying for fine dining, and you get to, you know, a couple free drinks. Those are worth $6 each, $8 each.
Whatever. Yeah. I mean, for me, it's really about the space. That's about it.
Yeah. I mean, it's not the food. It's really, for me, it gives me extra space where I can actually pull out my laptop and work.
Yeah. But I agree with that. I agree. You do need that space where I can work in economy plus usually.
It depends on who's sitting next to you.
Yeah, it's an elbow-space sort of issue more than anything.
Yep. Yeah. I agree. So, Foz, with no expat status, what are you going to be pursuing? Just United and maybe Alaska?
United and Alaska. I'm actually within reach of 3 million on United.
Within reach?
Within reach.
Are you going to let us know when you're, like, one flight away?
I will. I need to figure out which flight, because knowing my luck, it'll be something stupid like Newark-Pittsburgh, and I refuse to make that my 3 million-mile flight.
Well, we should all come along. I'll book a flight to be on it with you.
Yeah, we could do that.
Yeah. And Seth.
Maybe we could do the 77W.
Yeah, there you go. I like it.
Yeah.
And Seth, you
have... when you two get business class seats, and I'm stuck in the back.
we'll get you up front. We'll find a way.
We'll get you some champagne.
Can we do it Pakistan Air style and just let me stand in the aisle next to you the whole time?
Yeah,
we could totally do that.
Yeah. Or we could do it like...
Attendants would go for that during takeoff?
Oh, yeah. I read that article and I'm like, oh, of course they did. I didn't even know what more to say.
Oh, no, they're vehemently denying it, but also penalizing all the crew who were involved for, you know, doing
Or Seth, we could do what you guys did and just, you know, on the island hopper and just come back and grab you out of coach. And you're sitting up here.
They are only getting penalized.
Someone on a plane. That was great.
They're only getting penalized because the press found out. Not right. Because they didn't.
Yep, exactly. Seth, you had a Norwegian cancellation. We should just talk about it just because it's an interesting topic and because it could help people who Norwegian will be flying to the U.S. soon. It's important, right?
Well, they already do.
But I'm just saying, like, the 7th.
There's going to be a lot more coming soon. So I have to start by saying it wasn't entirely their fault. Was waiting for departure on an afternoon, I guess 5:30 or 5:45 p.m. flight from London to Berlin. And some security officers, I thought they were customs now, I think they were just police, met the arriving plane. And that's never good. I could look down the jet bridge and instead of seeing, you know, a normal person in, you know, ground crew, I saw three guys in black police gear through the little window. They brought one person off the plane up into, you know, that's Gatwick has sort of the split level arrivals departures thing, like most international airports do.
Mm-hmm.
And they brought him up in up at the stairs out of the way of everybody else so the whole plane could offload and then blocked us from reboarding the plane, which turned into an hour long delay. Turns out the guy, depending on which version of the story you believe, either exposed himself on board, got in a fight with someone on board, or otherwise caused an incident. But it ended with them having to interview people and file complaints and this and that, and the crew timed out. And we're standing there. It's funny. It's like they started boarding, and it's Norwegian, so quick turns, this and that, and there's like a half waiting room behind the counters at the gate. So they moved like 40 or 50 of us through boarding. You know, scanned our boarding passes. Technically, we were on the plane at that point, according to the departure control system. And then we're just standing there and standing there. And like the guy next to me is getting more and more visibly and audibly upset. It was starting to get a little entertaining. You know, how could this happen? These people are incompetent. You know, the usual ranting, like, this never happens on my favorite airline. I can't believe I chose to fly this other airline this one time, and they have the worst service all time ever. It was amusing to me. But we're standing there waiting, and in between all this, I finally, like, put my hand up to make him shut up because I could hear just enough of, like, walkie-talkie crackling in the background. And I heard, that's why I heard crew timeout. I looked at him and said, we're not flying tonight. And someone else said, what do you mean? I'm like, it's a crew timeout. I was like, no, it's a hub. They'll get a replacement crew. And I'm like, I'm betting against that. And I put that on Twitter, too. I'm betting against us getting out of here tonight. And then, you know, another guy who flies, and this is his first time, another guy who flies Norwegian, I was like, no, it'll be fine. They can get a crew. And I was like, you say that now, but I'd be looking at backup flights if I were you. And that's when I was talking to you guys on chat. I booked my replacement flight before we canceled. I didn't want to take the risk of it not being available anymore. And flight canceled. So the text messages come through, flight canceled. Okay, fine. And then to get out of Gatwick, technically we'd cleared outbound immigration at that point. So they had to like escort us back into the immigration counters, except they just brought us through the main hallway and didn't take us to any special area. So we just went through immigration like normal. And I guess they warned the officers working immigration because you present your boarding pass. And I'm like, I presented my departure pass. And he looked at my, you know, passport again. He's like, you know, what were you doing here? Attending a meeting? How long? How long are you going to be here? I did the whole interrogation sort of again, but they let us, you know, obviously let me in, but without an extra stamp. He scanned it again, but didn't stamp it again. And so it was fine, right? I mean, flight canceled. The next flight, they actually had enough seats on the flight the next morning that most people were able to be rebooked on that. Oh, I forgot the part, by the way, when they canceled it and they had to get everybody together to get us out, they couldn't really do that very well because we'd all dispersed. So they're like teaching everybody to like, please come to the information counter. The information counter is this tiny little space in the corner with no PA system of its own and room for maybe 30 or 40 people if you're lucky. And you guys know me as being rather loud when I need to be. I actually played PA. Like the woman was saying things in a timid, quiet voice, and I would turn and yell at everybody else, this is what's happening. And then she'd give us the next piece of advice, and I'd turn and relay that piece of information. It was like, and then you need to return your duty free. And now you need to go to gate 14 so we can get the hell out of here.
Wait, how do you return duty free?
If you tell them your flight's canceled, apparently that's a thing.
Wow.
I don't know if they check it or not. So I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't start with the Johnny Walker if you're going to play that game. But
you don't really think about these things. I mean, it's just a random thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, but you can't, technically you're not leaving the country, so you can't take it with you. And I don't know how that applies if you're in, like, a connecting passenger. But anyway, so we get out, and they were rebooking most people for the next morning. Unfortunately, I was, my segment to Berlin was to get there in advance of starting another of my Berlin to New York round trip tickets. So I had to be in Berlin for my origination the next morning or I lost my whole ticket. That was like getting me home from that trip and starting the next one next week.
You had to be there.
I kind of had to be. If I lost the ticket for next week, it would have been the end of the world, but I still had to get home.
Yep.
So it was going to be bad. The British Airways flight was the only one that got in early enough. Like it's a 7 a.m. out of Heathrow that I landed, did a full immigration turn because there's no transit at Berlin, Tegel. And then like I was in Germany for, I think, 25 minutes. I stamped in and then cleared right back out, most of which was spent waiting in line. So it was fine. But like in the meantime, I had to go over to Heathrow to catch that flight. The Norwegian flight was an hour too late. It just wouldn't get me there in time. So I refunded that online. That was easy. But I had to get over to Heathrow, which I took the bus. National Express has a sort of direct bus service between the two airports. And I had to rebook my flight, which I did using Avios because I wasn't going to pay £500 for it. And I had to get a hotel. And I stayed at the hotel in the terminal. Turns out it was reasonably cheap, reasonably comfortable. Actually, I'd like a decent enough property. It was a little loud inside. Like the toilet thing is sort of almost like airplane sound vacuum as opposed to a traditional plumbing flush. So that was interesting. But I filed my claim with Norwegian. And I threw in there, give me the €200 compensation also. They denied that, and who knows if they really owe me that or not. It's a question of is it a security breach or is it a crew staffing issue? And I could see it both ways, but you know, I don't know what the actual ruling from the courts will be. But I think it's just a matter of course. Norwegian denies every EU 261 claim because they also denied my request for my hotel and the bus and the food to be compensated for when they are absolutely required to do that, no matter the reason for the cancellation. And part of me thinks they just read one part of the email and like, or the claim and just like copy and pasted different chunks of things back together to make the response. But I've replied back to them, not surprisingly, saying, actually, no, you need to fix that. You actually do owe me this money. At least pay me the part that you really owe me and we'll see what happens. The good news is at most I'm out £90, but, actually the other interesting part about that is I bought the ticket with my Chase Sapphire Reserve card. Click here to sign up now. and one of the reasons I use that card is their trip delay insurance is usually pretty good. It's up to $500 for, you know, an incident, covers your hotel, food, all those things. So in case Norwegian didn't pay, I figure I'd use that. When I called them while standing in the airport just to make sure that I'd be covered, they told me I wasn't. And I wasn't covered because I was not going to take the replacement flight Norwegian offered me. If I booked my own replacement flight, I was no longer entitled to the insurance, even if it would still require the overnight and the meals and all those things.
But how would they know?
Well, that's one of the questions, right? I try not to commit insurance fraud, so I was upfront with them in asking the questions and, you know, providing the details and the circumstances. You know, could I accept the Norwegian reroute, buy my hotel, get it claimed, and then decide, oh, maybe not, and cancel later? Like, what if the flight's delayed a second time and then I buy a new flight? Was I committing fraud when I did it the first time, even if I did it in good faith? And the craziest part of this whole thing is I called in a second time after I got home, like, and wasn't exhausted and didn't really have anything pressing. I called in, like, you know, shoot the shit with the guy and chat him up and see what the real deal is. And he said to me, and he's like, well, no, that's actually, you know, there's the rules that are published. And I get that he's just the phone rep, but it's like, there's the rules that you have. And then there's what the claims adjusters go through when you file a claim. And I can tell you that if you try to file a claim like this, they're going to ask you that question and they would deny it. And I said, okay, well, I'm reading, and there's a PDF of the coverage. It says what's covered and what's not, right? And you can get that online. And I said, I'm reading this PDF. It doesn't say that anywhere here. And his response was, I know it doesn't say that on any of the literature you have. It doesn't say it on any of the literature I have either, but I know that's the way they enforce the policy.
That's disturbing.
And I was like, what? Absolutely dumbfounded.
Is it that the ticket number has to stay the same, or you have to fly the exact same itinerary?
Idea. There kind of was, you have to stay with the original provider, was what they said. Is once you drop that common carrier, the incident ends and you're no longer covered. And so, So this guy was just customer service, and I called over the weekend, so the claims people were not there. That department was closed. I'm supposed to call back maybe tomorrow to try to get more details, and I'm going to write this whole thing up at some point, but that part of it was amazing to me. So I got to talk to one of the claims people.
What happens if United pushes you to American or Delta? Then does that no longer count?
you're apparent. I don't know, right? But you accepted the reroute United gave you. So by the what I understand these vague circumstances to be, you're still okay.
Okay.
I mean, to me, it seems very. It's very customer unfriendly because let's say that the flight, like, what about the replacement flight? What if it was delayed by any short measure or canceled again and you're stuck and you could have just booked the replacement on your. I mean,
remember their limit is $500 per incident. So they don't care. I asked her, like, the first rep I was talking to, like, so if you're telling me the next time they can get me out is a week later, or I could book a flight for tomorrow and I can spend $100 a night, you'd rather pay me $500 for 5 nights than $100 for 1 night and let me get to where I'm going. And this was, yep.
Wow. Well, it's something to keep in mind for our listeners if they're going to use Chase's insurance, travel insurance, and probably any other travel insurance, right? I'm sure it's...
Yeah,
probably...
I mean, you're right. That's the whole thing about travel insurance is like, and any insurance, right? Their whole goal is to screw you, take your money and not pay out. And I know they actually do some good things, and I kind of wish I had better health insurance right now because I need it. But even if they're going to try to screw me, but... It's the whole thing is just, I don't know what different travel insurance companies will offer on this front. I never would have guessed it was going to be this way with this one. So, you know, it's a crazy world.
Yeah. Last topic. We have maybe two topics, but I think we're running a little long. Let's just wrap it up with one last one because I'm sure it'll take a little bit. At JFK, there was a transcon flight from San Francisco to JFK. It was a Delta flight, and it was met by Customs and Border Patrol at the gate, and they were asking people for their documentation as they came off the plane. And someone took a picture of this and posted it on Twitter, and it became viral. And apparently, from what I've read, they were actually looking for a particular passenger, and CBP was only they were acting on behalf of another agency. They didn't say which agency. Was it ICE? I don't know. Was it, you know, the FBI? Who knows? But it raises some questions, and there's some other topics that have come out of this that I've been thinking about, and I thought the show was a good place to talk about it. One, what do you guys think about this? I think it's kind of crazy that they actually use the words papers. We're going to need to see your papers. I think that's asinine. What guy?
Your papers, please.
Exactly. Like, what? Who thought that was a good idea? And they told people they weren't going to be let off the plane if they didn't show them. So what do you guys think about that?
Well, to clarify, the officials later said it was all voluntary. So, you know, it wasn't forced, even though it actually was.
Yeah. I mean, they were standing at the door of the plane. So your options were.
Yeah, and it's unclear if you said no. Like, right, part of that is if the first person says yes and shows it, most everybody else is too.
Yep, exactly.
Most everybody else will, because who's going to say no at that point? Like, no one wants to fight and deal with getting arrested, even if you're right.
Yep.
Right.
So that's part of the problem. There's a couple things about it that make me wonder. One of them is the right of immigration to perform border checks not at the border.
Within 100 miles, right?
Right. There's that border zone. And I don't know how that translates to domestic flights versus if they set up a checkpoint in the terminal or something else. And I don't know if airports are – I think airports are considered the same thing. I know it's – or is it, maybe it's only land border crossings. I'm not sure. That's one thing that would be worth probably doing more research on. Oops. But I'm not entirely sure it's 100% illegal. It's certainly shitty.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, because in Texas, so we spent some time in West and South Texas. As you get about 55 to 60 miles from the border, north of the border, there's usually Border Patrol stations that you have to stop at, and you're required to stop to pass through. And it's a state highway or –
Yeah.
In some cases, it's even an interstate, depending on where you're at. I don't think there's anything on I-10 or anything, but yeah.
Same thing in California.
Yeah.
So the question that that I have with this is, we know it's possible to fly without an ID. You just have to go through a more thorough check at security.
Yeah.
What would happen in that situation?
Yeah, you can't provide it.
You would probably be detained.
Yeah. And I wonder what the legality of that is, right? Like, what's the... Because you can't show documentation, you are detained. I don't know. It seems.
Yeah, and just my quick scan of the interwebs suggests that the 100 mile CBP has the authority to operate within 100 miles of any external boundary. So that includes airports or in the case of New York being, you know, sufficiently close to the coast.
Yep. So, I mean, it raises a bunch of questions for me about how, you know, where we are with immigration and what's going to happen with traveling. Because I've read about people's phones being taken at, you know, the border.
Immigration.
And being searched. And you're being compelled to give that information, your passcode up and laptop passwords and things like that. And so for me, it's like, well, so what's the answer to, how I travel and maybe how other people travel? Do I get a second cell phone? Do I just not travel with a laptop? The one thing I would say for everyone is if you use your thumb to access your phone and you don't want to give up your passcode, when you travel outside the United States, you should change your passcode to not use the thumbprint or the fingerprint ID.
And that's a Fourth Amendment thing that's been ruled that your thumbprint can be compelled, much like a blood test or DNA, but they cannot compel you to give up your password if it comes to that.
Yeah. So if you don't want to give up your personal data, then I would recommend you change that.
But you still could end up detained for an indeterminate period of time while waiting for them to copy your phone's encrypted version off.
Yeah,
if exactly. they so choose, or copy your encrypted hard drive if they so choose. So it's a balancing act. Let's say you got to, at some level, you know, part of this is how much of a fight are you willing to put up, which sucks because the answer should be there should be no fight.
Yep. Yep.
Well, I mean, you know, I was reading what some people are suggesting doing is just packing up your phone before.
Then wipe it.
Yeah, wipe it on the plane. And then restore it when you get, you know, through the checkpoint.
Yep.
Right. Like iCloud or whatever will pretty much automate that.
You could do that.
And then you don't have you let them have it. You know, you're not putting up any sort of fight. They can't really say anything about it being blank.
Yep. That's true. I had read another suggestion was put all your social media accounts into have the social media provider should provide a vacation mode or something where it basically just closes your account temporarily.
Well, I think what the guys need to do, what Apple and Google and all need to do is turn off the port on the phone. So yeah, I'll unlock it. You can look at it, but you can't make a copy of it.
Mm. Yeah, that's a good point. Because, I mean, they were saying, you know, you can get the copy down. What is it? I think they said in, 1 minute they can copy a 64-gig iPhone.
Yeah. There's some companies that make the hardware to do it. But I have no problems. I really don't have anything to hide, so I don't really mind them taking a look at my phone. Where I have a problem is them making a copy to keep it around in some database for God knows who else to see.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, because one of the things, I watched this stupid show, it's not stupid, it's actually very entertaining, Australia Border Security, and it's kind of like their immigration and customs, I would recommend it, it's on Netflix, and it's hilarious how many people try to get through Australia border control with like food items, like from all over. People are like, oh yeah, no, that's meat, and they're like, yeah, it's food, you can't bring raw meat, and no, they're like, oh no, it's meat. No, it's food. That's what's on the form. but some of what they do is when they're trying to prove if someone is coming to work against their visa illegally, they will look at the phones. And so I was wondering how that worked. And apparently it's part of your agreement when you enter the country, when you enter Australia.
Interesting.
So
you consent to that search.
Yeah, I'd be interested if we have Australian citizens, kind of how that works. I would love to know. So if you want to leave a comment or something,
yeah, we should get Zeps back on.
Yeah, we should. I think it would be a great topic to have Zeps.
Also, he's just a fun guy to talk to.
Yeah, absolutely, we haven't had him on in a while. Yeah, I think that's a good show. What do you guys think? Should we wrap it up?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes. All right.
Oh, can I tell one more quick story? I'm sorry.
No, see, you shouldn't have said yes to wrapping it up. Okay, what you got?
Oh, well. British Airways, speaking of ridiculous trips, the one that I started that came back to New York, I had to make a change to it to go back to Berlin next week. And I needed to change both the city and the date. So I expected to pay a change fee plus fare difference.
Mm-hmm.
And I called in and asked what it was, and they told me they couldn't tell me. They had to talk to our rates desk, and they didn't have access to them, and it was going to take a while. So rather than having me wait on hold, they said they'd call me back. And I got a call back 24 hours later telling me that it was going to be $500, which was more than I expected. right, it should just be, you know, if I was staying in the same city, from the same city, it should just be change fee, which shouldn't be that much. And then I called back and was like, this doesn't make any sense. And I was told, oh no, that's definitely wrong. It's only $400. And so I called back today and was like, can you tell me exactly what fare class I was booked in? And so she starts telling me fare classes. I was apparently booked in an up fare, as it were, from economy to premium economy. So that sort of thing exists in BA system. So, you know, W, E, and T, I think, are the business class, are the premium economy booking codes.
Mm-hmm.
And I was booked into a Q fare. It was like a $17 or a $30 base fare or something ridiculously low like that, but that's why the ticket was so cheap. Plus, you know, YQ and everything else. And I was rebooked into an N fare, which is still not a World Traveler Plus ticket class, but also books into one of these upgraded, you know, it's an upgrade, so it books in directly. And the fare difference, I looked at it, I'm like, right, but the fare difference between these two tickets is only like $100, and I should only pay half of that because it's a round-trip fare. And the woman's like, oh, we need to talk to this person, and they'll email you, and this, and I raised a bit of a fit because I'm like, I'm not waiting on hold again. And they're just like, oh, but when this happens, we're going to refund you your Avios for the upgrade, because I'd upgraded the return ticket, and there's no upgrade space available. We're going to refund you. No, they can't refund the Avios. They keep the points, but they're going to refund me the $100 in taxes. So when they charge me a fare difference, you know, it's discounted. But in the end, and so she quotes me, it ended up being, instead of a 180 euro change fee, a $55 change fee.
Okay.
And instead of a $280 fare difference, it was a 67 euro fare difference. Wow. Which is what I think is actually what it should have been. So it ended up costing me $120 to change my ticket, which is the same price as I would have paid for either a flight or train back to JFK, and then having to pay half of that to do the change fee anyway. So now I'm flying out of DC instead. But like during the phone call, I was like, this can't be right. She's like, yes, it is. Yes, it is. Of course it is. Oh, wait a minute. No, it's not. Like, you were given bad information. I was like, damn it. Why do I have to talk to like five people to get you all to agree to this?
Yeah. That's a good question. I mean,
yeah, and
it's frustrating, and, right? Because you spend all the time on the phone. And
if I had just said, okay, they would have charged me that much the first time. And like, I was about to do it anyways. Like, I need to take the trip. I need to do the thing. I was like, well, shit, it's going to cost me $500, but here we go.
Yeah.
And I called back in. I was like, I'm going to ask one more time. And then I'll say yes, because no matter what they tell me, I have to do it. So it's the whole thing is like a little ridiculous.
But, I'm glad it worked out, man.
Yeah, me too. And I get to fly another 380, which that'll be fun in premium economy. It gives me, it's my fourth BA premium economy type this year.
Nice.
Wow.
Very nice.
And then the 744, the 789, and the 77W already.
And are you crediting this to BA? Is that the question you were going to ask, Foz?
Yep.
I'm actually credited to American.
Okay. All right. He's going to be expat, Foz.
Why American?
Why not? I have nothing in BA. I don't really care about the status so much, and the tier points isn't going to get me to gold.
But why not like Alaska?
Again, with mostly because I don't want to split the points up. And Alaska, I get that the redemptions have been good from using a points perspective, but I've never invested in building that account, and I don't want to start now. Mm. I'm not doing enough year over year, I don't think, to make it worthwhile.
If you've done five premium economy trips, I think you've done more than enough.
I think you've
actually five one ways. It's three round trips, but
that's still a fair bit.
It's really only like 40,000 miles.
Okay, I mean that's
so, almost I don't know, I just,
gold.
That's almost gold. Yeah.
I end up. I'll end up either platinum or platinum pro on American again. The interesting thing.
Come on, let's be real. You're not going to get platinum pro. They'll find a way to stiff you again.
They probably will, but. The interesting thing about these tickets is because they're booked in premium economy and they're on a partner, you earn EQDs based on distance times the multiplier for a class of service. And so I'm actually earning well more EQDs than I'm spending dollars, like 5x or 6x, I think.
You might be executive platinum.
I told you.
I need a couple more of them. And actually, I have an Open Skies ticket that I'll credit to them later in the year. And some of them are like, there's another thing about Alaska, and now we've gone completely off the rails here, but like some of them have, I feel like there's been questions in the past about code share and flight numbers and which ones really do credit and which ones do earn and trying to figure that out. And some of mine are like, you know, AA flight number on BA metal and how does that really credit?
Mm.
And
it doesn't.
Right. So, I'm already at 2,400 EQDs for the year.
Wow.
And 17,000 EQMs.
Nice.
Because they're premium economy seats.
Very nice.
So,
very nice.
Anywho, I tend to put my status where I'm actually flying.
Yeah, and it's potentially
on American.
Yeah, you could fly more American probably out of JFK than you would ever fly Alaska, right?
Yes.
But then again, you could just credit the American flights to Alaska as well.
I could, but I the value proposition there just isn't really solid to me.
True. Oh, good times. Well,
anywho.
Thanks, listeners, for checking us out this week, and leave us a comment on our website, moredotsmorelines.com, or on Twitter, @dotslines. Thanks for listening, and talk to you next time. Bye, guys.
Take care.
Take care.